Chapter 106. Tom Pinch departs to seek his fortune. What he finds at starting, oh, what a different town Salisbury was in Tom Pinch's eyes, to be sure, when the substantial Pecksniff of his heart melted away into an idle dream. He possessed the same faith in the wonderful shops, the same intensified appreciation of the mystery and wickedness of the place, made the same exalted estimate of its wealth, population, and resources, and yet it was not the old city nor anything like it. He walked into the market, while they were getting breakfast ready for him at the inn, and though it was the same market as of old, crowded by the same buyers and sellers, brisk with the same business, noisy with the same confusion of tongues and cluttering of fowls in coops, fair with the same display of rolls of butter, newly made, set forth in linen cloths of dazzling whiteness, green with the same fresh show of dewy vegetables, dainty with the same array in higglers' baskets of small shaving glasses, laces, braces, trouser straps, and hardware, savory with the same unstinted show of delicate pig's feet, and pies made precious by the pork that once had walked upon them, still it was strangely changed to Tom. For, in the center of the marketplace, he missed a statue he had set up there as in all other places of his personal resort, and it looked cold and bare without that ornament. The change lay no deeper than this, for Tom was far from being sage enough to know that, having been disappointed in one man, it would have been a strictly rational and eminently wise proceeding to have revenged himself upon mankind in general by mistrusting them one and all. Indeed, this piece of justice, though it is upheld by the authority of divers profound poets and honorable men, bears a nearer resemblance to the justice of that good vizier in the Thousand and One Nights, who issues orders for the destruction of all the porters in Baghdad, because one of that unfortunate fraternity is supposed to have misconducted himself, than to any logical, not to say Christian, system of conduct known to the world in later times. Tom had so long been used to steep the Pecksniff of his fancy in his tea, and spread him out upon his toast, and take him as a relish with his beer, that he made but a poor breakfast on the first morning after his expulsion. Nor did he much improve his appetite for dinner by seriously considering his own affairs, and taking counsel thereon with his friend the organist's assistant. The organist's assistant gave it as his decided opinion that whatever Tom did, he must go to London, for there was no place like it. Which may be true in the main, though hardly, perhaps, in itself, a sufficient reason for Tom's going there. But Tom had thought of London before, and had coupled with it thoughts of his sister, and of his old friend John Westlock, whose advice he naturally felt disposed to seek in this important crisis of his fortunes. To London, therefore, he resolved to go, and he went away to the coach office at once, to secure his place. The coach being already full, he was obliged to postpone his departure until the next night. But even this circumstance had its bright side as well as its dark one, for though it threatened to reduce his poor purse with unexpected country charges, it afforded him an opportunity of writing to Mrs. Lupin and appointing his box to be brought to the old finger post at the old time, which would enable him to take that treasure with him to the metropolis, and save the expense of its carriage. So, apostrophe said Tom, comforting himself, it's very nearly as broad as it's long. Apostrophe, and it cannot be denied that, when he had made up his mind to even this extent, he felt an unaccustomed sense of freedom, a vague and indistinct impression of holiday-making which was very luxurious. He had his moments of depression and anxiety, and they were, with good reason, pretty numerous. But still, it was wonderfully pleasant to reflect that he was his own master, and could plan and scheme for himself. It was startling, thrilling, vast, difficult to understand. It was a stupendous truth, teeming with responsibility and self-distrust. but in spite of all his cares, it gave a curious relish to the viands at the inn, and interposed a dreamy haze between him and his prospects, in which they sometimes showed to magical advantage. In this unsettled state of mind, Tom went once more to bed in the low four-poster, to the same immovable surprise of the effigies of the former landlord and the fat ox, and in this condition, passed the whole of the succeeding day. When the coach came round at last with London blazoned in letters of gold upon the boot, it gave Tom such a turn, that he was half disposed to run away. But he didn't do it, for he took his seat upon the box instead, and looking down upon the four greys, felt as if he were another grey himself, or, at all events, a part of the turnout, and was quite confused by the novelty and splendor of his situation. And really it might have confused a less modest man than Tom, to find himself sitting next that coachman, for of all the swells that ever flourished a whip professionally, he might have been elected emperor. He didn't handle his gloves like another man, but put them on, even when he was standing on the pavement, quite detached from the coach, as if the four greys were, somehow or other, at the ends of the fingers. It was the same with his hat. He did things with his hat, which nothing but an unlimited knowledge of horses, and the wildest freedom of the road, could ever have made him perfect in. Valuable little parcels were brought to him with particular instructions, and he pitched them into this hat, and stuck it on again, as if the laws of gravity did not admit of such an event as its being knocked off or blown off, and nothing like an accident could befall it. The guard too. 70 breezy miles a day were written in his very whiskers. His manners were a canter, his conversation a round trot. He was a fast coach upon a downhill turnpike road. He was all pace. A wagon couldn't have moved slowly, with that guard and his key bugle on the top of it. These were all foreshadowings of London, Tom thought, as he sat upon the box, and looked about him. Such a coachman, and such a guard, never could have existed between Salisbury and any other place. The coach was none of your steady-going, yokel coaches, but a swaggering, rakish, dissipated London coach, up all night, and lying by all day, and leading a devil of a life. It cared no more for Salisbury than if it had been a hamlet. It rattled noisily through the best streets, defied the cathedral, took the worst corners sharpest, went cutting in everywhere, making everything get out of its way, and spun along the open country road, blowing a lively defiance out of its key bugle, as its last glad parting legacy. It was a charming evening, mild and bright, and even with the weight upon his mind which arose out of the immensity and uncertainty of London, Tom could not resist the captivating sense of rapid motion through the pleasant air. The four greys skimmed along, as if they liked it quite as well as Tom did. The bugle was in as high spirits as the greys. The coachman chimed in sometimes with his voice. The wheels hummed cheerfully in unison. The brasswork on the harness was an orchestra of little bells. And thus, as they went clinking, jingling, rattling smoothly on, the whole concern, from the buckles of the leader's coupling reins to the handle of the hind boot, was one great instrument of music. Yo-ho, past hedges, gates, and trees, past cottages and barns, and people going home from work. Yo-ho, past donkey chaises, drawn aside into the ditch, and empty carts with rampant horses, whipped up at a bound upon the little watercourse, and held by struggling carters close to the five-barred gate, until the coach had passed the narrow turning in the road. Yo-ho, by churches dropped down by themselves in quiet nooks, with rustic burial grounds about them, where the graves are green, and daisies sleep for it as evening on the bosoms of the dead. Yo-ho, past streams, in which the cattle cool their feet, and where the rushes grow, past paddock fences, farms, and rickyards, past last year's stacks, cut, slice by slice, away, and showing, in the waning light, like ruined gables, old and brown. Yo-ho, down the pebbly dip, and through the merry water splash, and up at a canter to the level road again. Yo-ho! Yo-ho! was the box there when they came up to the old finger post? The box. Was Mrs. Lupin herself? Had she turned out magnificently as a hostess should, in her own chaise cart, and was she sitting in a mahogany chair, driving her own horse dragon, who ought to have been called Dumpling, and looking lovely? Did the stagecoach pull up beside her, shaving her very wheel, and even while the guard helped her man up with the trunk, did he send the glad echoes of his bugle careering down the chimneys of the distant Pecksniff, as if the coach expressed its exultation in the rescue of Tom Pinch? This is kind indeed. ... said Tom, bending down to shake hands with her. I didn't mean to give you this trouble. ... Mr. Pinch. ... cried the hostess of the dragon. Well, it's a pleasure to you, I know, ... said Tom, squeezing her hand heartily. Is there any news? ... The hostess shook her head. Say you saw me, ... said Tom, and that I was very bold and cheerful, and not a bit downhearted, and that I entreated her to be the same, for all is certain to come right at last. Goodbye. ... You'll write when you get settled, Mr. Pinch? ... said Mrs. Lupin. When I get settled. ... cried Tom, with an involuntary opening of his eyes. Oh, yes, I'll write when I get settled. Perhaps I had better write before, because I may find that it takes a little time to settle myself, not having too much money, and having only one friend. I shall give your love to the friend, by the way. You were always great with Mr. Westlock, you know. Goodbye. ... Goodbye. ... said Mrs. Lupin, hastily producing a basket with a long bottle sticking out of it. Take this. Goodbye. ... Do you want me to carry it to London for you? ... cried Tom. She was already turning the chaise cart round. No, said Mrs. Lupin. It's only a little something for refreshment on the road. Sit fast, Jack. Drive on, sir. All right. Goodbye. ... She was a quarter of a mile off, before Tom collected himself, and then he was waving his hand lustily, and so was she. And that's the last of the old finger post, ... thought Tom, straining his eyes, where I have so often stood to see this very coach go by, and where I have parted with so many companions. I used to compare this coach to some great monster that appeared at Cirta in times to bear my friends away into the world. And now it's bearing me away, to seek my fortune, heaven knows where, and how. ... It made Tom melancholy, to picture himself walking up the lane and back to Pecksniff's as of old. And being melancholy, he looked downwards at the basket on his knee, which he had for the moment forgotten. She is the kindest and most considerate creature in the world, ... thought Tom. Now I know that she particularly told that man of hers not to look at me, on purpose to prevent my throwing him a shilling. I had it ready for him all the time, and he never once looked towards me, whereas that man naturally, for I know him very well, would have done nothing but grin and stare. Upon my word, the kindness of people perfectly melts me. ... Here he caught the coachman's eye. The coachman winked. Remarkable fine woman for her time of life, ... said the coachman. I quite agree with you, ... returned Tom. So she is. ... Finer than many a young un, I mean to say, ... observed the coachman. Eh? ... than many a young one, ... Tom assented. I don't care for 'em myself when they're too young, ... remarked the coachman. This was a matter of taste, which Tom did not feel himself called upon to discuss. You'll seldom find 'em possessing correct opinions about refreshment, for instance, when they're too young, you know, ... said the coachman. A woman must have arrived at maturity before her mind's equal to coming provided with a basket like that. ... Perhaps you would like to know what it contains? Apostrophe apostrophe said Tom, smiling. As the coachman only laughed, and as Tom was curious himself, he unpacked it and put the articles, one by one, upon the footboard. A cold roast fowl, a packet of ham in slices, a crusty loaf, a piece of cheese, a paper of biscuits, half a dozen apples, a knife, some butter, a screw of salt, and a bottle of old sherry. There was a letter besides, which Tom put in his pocket. The coachman was so earnest in his approval of Mrs. Lupin's provident habits, and congratulated Torn so warmly on his good fortune, that Tom felt it necessary, for the lady's sake, to explain that the basket was a strictly platonic basket, and had merely been presented to him in the way of friendship. When he had made the statement with perfect gravity, for he felt it incumbent on him to disabuse the mind of this lax rover of any incorrect impressions on the subject, he signified that he would be happy to share the gifts with him, and proposed that they should attack the basket in a spirit of good fellowship at any time in the course of the night which the coachman's experience and knowledge of the road might suggest, as being best adapted to the purpose. From this time they chatted so pleasantly together, that although Tom knew infinitely more of unicorns than horses, the coachman informed his friend the guard at the end of the next stage, that rum as the box seat looked, he was as good a one to go, in pint of conversation, as ever he'd wished to sit by. Apostrophe, yo-ho, among the gathering shades. Making of no account the deep reflections of the trees, but scampering on through light and darkness, all the same, as if the light of London 50 miles away were quite enough to travel by, and some to spare. Yo-ho, beside the village green, where cricket players linger yet, and every little indentation made in the fresh grass by batter wicket, baller player's foot, sheds out its perfume on the night. Away with four fresh horses from the bald-faced stag, where topers congregate about the door admiring, and the last team with traces hanging loose, go roaming off towards the pond, until observed and shouted after by a dozen throats, while volunteering boys pursue them. Now, with a clattering of hoofs and striking out of fiery sparks, across the old stone bridge, and down again into the shadowy road, and through the open gate, and far away, away, into the wold. Yo-ho! Yo-ho, behind there, stop that bugle for a moment. Come creeping over to the front, along the coach roof, guard, and make one at this basket. Not that we slacken in our pace the while, not we. We rather put the bits of blood upon their metal, for the greater glory of the snack. Ah! It is long since this bottle of old wine was brought into contact with the mellow breath of night, you may depend, and rare good stuff it is to wet a bugler's whistle with. Only try it. Don't be afraid of turning up your finger, Bill, another pull. Now, take your breath, and try the bugle, Bill. There's music. There's a tone. Apostrophe apostrophe over the hills and far away, apostrophe indeed. Yo-ho! The skittish mare is all alive tonight. Yo-ho! Yo-ho! See the bright moon! High up before we know it, making the earth reflect the objects on its breast like water. Hedges, trees, low cottages, church steeples, blighted stumps and flourishing young slips, have all grown vain upon the sudden, and mean to contemplate their own fair images till morning. The poplars yonder rustle, that their quivering leaves may see themselves upon the ground. Not so the oak, trembling does not become him, and he watches himself in his stout old burly steadfastness, without the motion of a twig. The moss-grown gate, ill-poised upon its creaking hinges, crippled and decayed swings to and fro before its glass, like some fantastic dowager, while our own ghostly likeness travels on, yo-ho, yo-ho, through ditch and brake, upon the ploughed land and the smooth. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.